meetings, the date is May 1st, the time is 7:08. Present today are Representative Moses, Representative Hines, Representative Coyne, Representative Whitaker, Representative Hocker, Representative Wyrock, Representative Wilson. Also in attendance, Representative Seaton, Representative Samuels, Representative Ogg. I think that's everybody. We have before us today, or we will have before us today, HB 293. Representative Hocker.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, for purposes of discussion here, I move House Bill number 293-LS1064, the D version.
Without objection, that bill is before us. We have with us today Larry Persley, Deputy Director of the Department of Revenue. Mr. Persley, if you could come forward, please. Identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Larry Persley, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. And I guess just briefly, what you have before you today, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, is a, I don't know if I'd call it a basic sales tax bill, but it is a sales and use tax bill that includes none of the exemptions that were discussed in previous legislative sessions in terms of medical care, prescription drugs, food, caps, where the tax would only apply to a certain amount of the purchase and then stop. This is, I guess, a starting point if you were to look at a sales and use tax and then from here start to make the policy decisions that are going to be up to you as a legislature to see how you want it implemented, what you want taxed, if you want exemptions. The sales and use tax before you today would take over administration, enforcement, and collection from the municipalities. And we really believe that if you're going to have a sales tax that is going to work in the state of Alaska and work particularly for businesses that are going to be collecting the tax on our behalf, you have to give them one set of laws, one set of exemptions, of rules, one central point of enforcement, collection, and audits, so that they're dealing with just one taxing entity rather than 98 different taxing entities between the communities, the boroughs, and the state. The fiscal note, just briefly, we estimate, and certainly as someone who's done fiscal notes for years, I worry sometimes that people think they are a science. They're certainly just an estimation, much like our oil price revenue forecast. We believe roughly that if you have a sales and use tax on the state of Alaska without significant exemptions, without caps, without other measures that would detract from the revenue, you would gain about $110 million for every 1% of a statewide year-round sales tax. So as a 3% sales and use tax as proposed in House Bill 293 before you, you're looking at about $330 million a year in revenue to the state. The first fiscal year in this tax in the bill before you would take effect January 1st of 2004. Tax returns generally would be due the next month, so you would get 5 months worth of tax returns. That first fiscal year, FY04, you're looking at about $135 million in revenue. $330 after that, you might look at the fiscal note and notice that it is a flat $330 million. Certainly, we would believe as the economy continues to grow, that number would grow with it. But for purposes of fiscal notes, generally, we do not include inflation or growth estimates. But certainly, it would be everyone's contention, everyone's hope that as Alaska's economy grows, so would the revenue from a sales tax. The fiscal note briefly on page 2 some of the items that would be exempted under the sales tax, and these are exemptions that we believe are essential to making it work, making it fair, giving it the clarity that is needed. Items such as sale for resale, the point where the sales taxes, you tax the final end purchaser, the retailer, at the retail point. You don't add on a sales tax every step of the way. If the items are ingredients or components in manufacturing and mining, sales to government agencies, purchases made with food stamps or WIC coupons, certainly wages, insurance premiums, dividend and interest that you earn. I guess I would say these are common sense exemptions. I could go through the whole bill, but I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, if you're looking for a detailed review of it or just kind of an opening. One thing And we do have Dan Dickinson, who's director of the tax division on the line from Anchorage, that he could talk about for a few minutes. We would strongly recommend that if Alaska adopts a sales and use tax, that we conform with what's called the Streamlined Sales Tax Project. I believe in your packet today is an executive summary of the sales tax, Streamlined Sales Tax Project that we've provided. And as Dan will explain, that's a nationwide effort on the part of many states to adopt a, well, not to use the word again, but a streamline, a simplified approach to dealing with sales and use taxes, not just for customers, but particularly for the businesses who we are asking to collect the money on our behalf. As nationwide trade in internet sales, mail order, phone continues to grow, states have realized they're losing significant amount of money to those sales on sales tax revenues. And part of the goal of the Streamlined Sales Tax Project is to come up with some nationwide standards so that it would be easier to work with the business community for states to start collecting those sales tax revenues. We are not collecting them now because we don't have one, but if you're going to have a sales and use tax, we would recommend you put Alaska in a position so that it can collect sales tax on internet sales, mail order sales coming into the state rather than foregoing that revenue. With that, Mr. Chairman, if you wanted, we could have Mr. Dickinson.
It's appropriate that we do so. That's a good time for you, sir. Mr. Dickinson, are you there?
Mr. Chairman, I am here.
Please identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dan Dickinson. I'm the director of the Department of Revenue Tax Division. We administer 19 different tax types, and I'd like to take a couple minutes to talk about an important aspect of a tax that Alaska doesn't have, and that's the Streamlined Sales Tax Project. What is the Streamlined Sales Tax Project, and what could it mean for Alaska? It will increase the likelihood that we can get out-of-state businesses to collect sales taxes for us on their sales into Alaska. Gives us a precise framework for simplicity, fairness, uniformity, and certainty, all worthy goals of any tax program. And it will make Alaska a friendlier place to do business than if we instituted a complex maze for a sales tax. Consider for a moment a business selling its goods nationwide. First of all, it is confronted with 7,500 different taxing jurisdictions, states, cities, counties, and special jurisdictions such as transit districts, school districts, or my favorite, the Brewers Stadium District in Wisconsin. Many of these jurisdictions overlap. Each might have a different sales tax, rules, and different rates. Now, suppose, for example, the state taxes clothing, but the county exempts clothing, but not athletic gear. But the transit district taxes clothing, but considers a softball mitt to be clothing. The business would have to figure out which transit district the count and which county the address was in, and then decide whether the purchase was taxable for each one, and if so, what was the tax rate. Now, if our example were in Mississippi, there could be 7 different tax rates depending on what was sold, ranging from an 8% drink or 8% tax on drink for human consumption through vending machines to a 1% tax on services performed by electrical power associations. After withholding the tax, that same business might be subject to 3 different audits, including the one that said, oh, yeah, our rates changed 2 weeks ago. What do you mean you didn't know? Now, suppose that consumer bought the item and sent the check to the business's corporate headquarters in Missouri, who then notified its distributor in Oregon, who found the closest warehouse where the product was in North Carolina, who called up the shipping firm in South Carolina to deliver it back to the purchaser in Virginia. In what state did the sale occur? Now, each state may have its own sourcing rules, and each state could say, well, that sale occurred in our state. Now, consider the phone call itself that was used to place this order. I'm not going to flesh out the full example, but if you think about it, it should come as no surprise that AT&T is one of the biggest backers of the Streamlined Sales Tax Project. AT&T nationwide files about 70,000 different sales tax returns a year. Back in 1967, the U.S. Supreme Court looked at all this and issued its famous, or for some of us, infamous, Bellows Hess ruling. Illinois had a sales and use tax that asked that Bellows Hess, a firm in Missouri that sold goods by mail to purchasers in Illinois, be required to collect sales tax and remit it to Missouri. Supreme Court said that would be an intolerable burden on interstate commerce to require an out-of-state business to do all the work necessary to accurately collect the tax. As such, no state could ask that of businesses outside its legal jurisdiction. Now, before we roll our eyes too much, let's look at what a retailer looking at Alaska sees. For example, on the Kenai Peninsula borough, the borough has a 2% sales tax, and within the borough, City of Homer, for example, has a 3% tax, City of Ketchikan has none. Another example, the City of Ketchikan and the Ketchikan Gateway Borough each have separate sales taxes. Newspapers and publications are taxable in the city, but not under the borough tax. Residential rentals are taxable by the borough, but not by the city. Many attempts to remedy this mess fell short over the 35 years since the court case, while the amount of interstate commerce has grown and grown. Finally, as internet sales hit, the streamlined sales tax project looks like it might have created a good answer. What is that answer? First of all, they have a short statute that each participating state must adopt, the Uniform Sales and Use Tax Administration. The legislative finding to that act says, this state should enter into an agreement with one or more states to simplify and modernize sales and use tax administration in order to substantially reduce the burden of tax compliance for all the sellers and for all types of commerce. Then the agreement between the states sets forth the framework that a state tax must conform to. Those are uniform definitions. Any state that, for example, taxes groceries, that exempts groceries but taxes restaurant food, will have to treat a ham and cheese croissant from the Safeway deli the same way as a croissant sandwich in a restaurant. Rate simplification. State may just have one tax rate covering all categories except special allowances made for food and drugs, which may have a lower rate. Each city can have its own rate, or each other jurisdiction added to the state's tax rate. It requires state administration. The state is responsible to track the local changes, provide a central point of administration. There are also uniform sourcing rules, audit rules, and administration of exempt transactions. 38 states have brought this project together. It is their hope to ask Congress for a law allowing that if a state is a participating member of this project, then every business would be required to collect tax on items sold into that state. Under the streamlined sales tax project, such a collection would not be unreasonable because it would no longer be an unreasonable burden on interstate commerce. Before closing, let me mention a couple of things the streamlined sales tax project does not do. It does not set the tax rate in any state or city. That is up to you and the municipal assemblies. It does not set out what you can decide to exempt or not exempt. It just requires that if you exempt something for which the streamlined sales tax project has a definition, that you use the definition. This project creates a framework in which the legislatures can still make the critical policy decisions. As you think about a sales tax, please think about the streamlined sales tax project. We would be the first state to adopt a sales tax since that project came to being, and we have a chance to learn from other states' mistakes. So I'll try to answer any questions you may have, though I usually do better answering questions on taxes that we do have than taxes that we don't.
I heard it right.
Thank you, Mr. Dickinson. I must say that I've listened to you for a number of years, and that's the most animated I've ever heard you. I don't know what that.
Chairman, we really have a chance to do things right here, and I would pass up the opportunity.
Thank you, and thank you for taking the opportunity. Mr. Priestley.
Mr. Chairman, just one thing to point out to members in your package. You have an executive summary of the streamlined sales tax project provided to you, and that also includes a map showing what states are involved or not involved. So I just want to point that out to the members.
Very good. For the sake of expeditiousness, let's proceed in the following manner. We'll take questions, if there are any, for Mr. Dickinson, and then we'll come back to Mr. Persley and ask him to explain in a bit more depth the fiscal note and the attachments to the fiscal note. So are there questions or comments for Mr. Dickinson?
Right.
Representative Hawker.
Mr. Dickinson, if you could, as you presented the streamlined sales tax project, I know there's a number of us that are quite familiar with it, having worked with it both professionally and now in a legislative capacity, but I had a perception that there was still some, it's easy for us to understand exactly where you're at, but could you go back and, try to broadly and succinctly reiterate what the streamlined sales project is, and in particular what it's not. And I'd ask kind of it is not a prototype statute, but that it's policy guidelines and position papers to follow, kind of how the structure works and what folks will find when they look on the streamlined sales tax website.
Thank you. Yes. Representative Hawker, through the chair. I think you've actually laid out what it is. It is not a prototype sales tax act. Merely passing the model legislation would not be the final step. What it does is it takes many of the troubling areas of sales tax, and especially the areas that are troublesome because each state has different rules, and it sets a uniform set of rules. For places where uniformity is not required, it allows the local jurisdictions, states, or localities to make the critical decisions that are important to them. I think, again, if I can go to the broad part first before I get succinct, it's not that AT&T wants to avoid taxes or wants to get away on the cheap. It's simply, it is more expensive in some cases for them to do the billing for a phone call than it is for them to actually route the phone call. Now, I may be, obviously they have a huge capital investment in infrastructure, but when they have to figure out each jurisdiction and what they go through and what the rates are, and have to keep up to date on all 7,500 possible changes, including ones that sprout up that they didn't know about before, it becomes exceedingly difficult. Secondly, it seems almost trivial, but if the difference between a transit district or a school district doesn't line up with a zip code, it's very hard for them when they send out a bill to even be sure they've got the addressee in the right set of jurisdictions. So you're simply facing a horrendous complex, and the natural reaction in most cases is to say, well, I just won't. If I don't have a presence in that state, I don't have to. While that's particularly important for Alaska is, of course, there are many businesses that sell in here that do not have a presence here. And under the current rules, they simply don't have to collect the sales tax. We're left with an obligation to try to go after consumers on the use tax side. And for all intents and purposes, we're not going to do that, and it wouldn't be successful if we tried. So what we're trying to do here, I'll get to the succinct part now, is create a structure so the business can go ahead and do our business, collect the tax, and remit it to us without having an intolerable burden of trying to figure out what it is that we're trying to do when we say you owe a tax.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Barra.
Thank you, Mr. Dickinson. Mr. Pursley. In looking at your testimony, Mr. Dickinson, this Uniform Sales and Use Tax Administration Act, if the Alaska legislature were to address that, and looking down the pike, if it were to adopt it, would it involve the state of Alaska entering into sort of an interstate compact with one or more states in it before the tax would take place or be in effect in Alaska, or would it be concurrent, or what is this agreement mechanism between other states? How does that work?
Representative Weirach, through the chair. Yes. If we were to pass the act, then we would become a participating state with certain rights and certain obligations. Now, no state has ever passed the act without having a sales tax in place, so there may be some curious aspects of that, but presumably that we brought the two on at the same time, we would become a member state. There would be certain rules that would apply. There are also some obligations, but the main obligation that would come on us from passing the act would be to make sure that as we passed our sales tax act itself, that we met the requirements within the uniformity standards or the other standards in the act. So again, the sales tax act itself and the uniform piece. Let me back up. If this is an example that doesn't illuminate, stop me. But in our income tax, we have Title 4319 and Title 4320 for the corporate income tax. Title 4319 is the multi-state tax act, which sort of sets out the broad principles 4320 then is the specific implementation of those principles for Alaska. And that's essentially how I would view what we would do in this context.
Follow up to you, Mr. Dickinson, or Mr. Pursley. Some communities already have sales taxes, we know, from information provided known to the some of the committee members now. Some folks in the legislature come from communities that have sales taxes. If Alaska were to adopt a sales tax or enter into this Uniform Sales and Use Tax Administration Act with other states and then adopt the act, or as you've indicated, adopt the act and then enter into these agreements, what happens to the local community's ability to implement a sales tax and garner the benefit of their own local sales tax? And
Mr. Chairman, if I could, the bill before you rewrites that section of Title 29, which deals with municipal powers, and simply it would put the state in the business, the legislature, in the state of setting the exemptions, the enforcement, the collection, the administration of a sales tax. The municipality, in effect, would simply tell us they want 2%, 3%, 4%, and that would be collected from businesses in their jurisdiction and sent back to the municipality.
So the local control is sort of delegated back to the city. It's the state assumes it and then delegates it back through payment, through a check, I guess.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Weirach, no, the municipality would get the money, but the municipalities could, in essence, shut down their sales tax offices.
Right.
So, and the municipal code in Juneau's case, which has, last time I looked, 38 sales tax exemptions, those would go away. It would be the state exemptions that would be controlling.
So where you have a community with a 5% sales tax now, if this act were to be in place, the local sales tax would go away and the city would simply say, we want 5% sales tax on sales from our community, and this is what the amount we want would be, or the state would say, this is what we've calculated the amount would be, and we'll send you that amount.
Through the chair, Representative Weirach, if this went into effect, the municipality would tell the state how much, what rate they want collected in their municipality. They would tell the state they want 4% or 5%. They wouldn't tell the state we want 20 million. They would say this is the percentage set by municipal ordinance, and the state would collect it. Now, in the case of, for example, someone like Juneau, I have not looked at the numbers, but Juneau does have a lot of exemptions. Generally, for example, services are subject to sales tax in Juneau. If you go to your accountant to have them do your tax return, you pay a 5% sales tax. If you hire a lobbyist in Juneau and pay them, there's no sales tax. Lobbyist services are exempt from sales tax in Juneau. But in Juneau's case, if there's a tighter state sales tax code with fewer exemptions, Juneau might, or very likely, could get the same amount of money to their municipal treasury with a lower tax rate.
And I intend this to be general, not to Juneau, although I'm from there, but I want to get the policy, the statewide policy implications. According to the comparison of state and local retail sales tax chart that was passed out, we have a maximum of 7% that can be levied by communities as a sales tax. Is that correct? No. Under Title 29?
Mr. Chairman, the highest in the state is 7% right now.
So why wouldn't, under this program, doesn't that mean it would be an incentive for every community in the state to say we want 7% and we would have had a 7% but for this sales tax, and that's what every community would do? Isn't that what everybody community would likely do?
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I think I'm not aware of a limit in Title 29 on municipal sales tax. The highest charge right now is 7%, but that's an issue certainly the committee is going to need to deal with. Those cities that are at 5 and 6 and 7 are going to be very worried that if the state adds on 3, it's going to hurt their local economies. That may be something the committee wants to deal with. You could, for example, set something up in statute where you have something like a grandfather clause that say the combined state-local rate as of this date may not exceed 8%. And I'm just throwing this out. So you could have, at that date, freeze it and say this can't go any higher in those cities. Maybe the community would take 6 or 7, the state would get 1 or 2 rather than the full 3. So in those communities, they don't get up to 9 or 10.
No, I understand, it's also my understanding that under this scheme that you're discussing and Mr. Dickinson are discussing, the local sales tax would be supplanted by the statewide policy, and that the city would then have an incentive to say we want the 7% sales tax refunded to our community through this act. And even if they don't have a sales tax now.
No.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Dickinson.
I guess that it would be an additive. So, for example, if you were in the city of Anchorage, which does not have a sales tax, if the city did not introduce one, everyone would be paying 3% on goods and services. If the Anchorage were to go out and add the 7%, then everybody would be paying 10%. And that's a decision that remains with the locality, that the overall level that they wish to have for a sales tax. Right now, the decision for their municipality will be someplace between 0 and 100%. If the state has a 3% sales tax, they'll now have the option of having a tax someplace between 3 and 100%. But the point is, if you add that, before you can get the 7% refunded, you also have to have the 7% added on all goods and services sold in your community.
And there's nothing in statute now or in this legislation that sets a maximum rate for the combined state municipal tax rate.
Excuse me, for the record, the last speaker was Representative Persley. We do have a record. We do have to keep that straight. Representative Weirock.
Follow up. And in introducing this in your preliminary testimony, where you talked about the exemptions that were already in this act, where you say these exemptions were designed to be fair, workable, commonsensical, streamlined, and simplified. Coming from a community that has a sales tax with 5 or 6 pages of exemptions, I know that you start getting the people that start getting the exemptions then will start tailoring their lobbying efforts to be fair, workable, sensible, streamlined, simplified, and therefore we should be part of the exemption process. And don't you see that as a potential risk? Just becoming an exemption bill as opposed to a sales tax bill?
Mr. Persley.
Through the chair, Representative Weirock, and I guess as public official, it's going to be incumbent on you to hold the line against the lobbyists who want to turn it into an exemption bill. Because certainly that, you know, we often hear the term Christmas tree bill when it refers to appropriations. This could become the equivalent. You could end up with 38 exemptions like Juno and find that you have to have a much higher rate to raise the same amount of revenue.
And on that point, Representative Hawker.
Mr. Chairman, I could put perhaps a little bit of a framework around the first question raised by Representative Weirock. I'd like to get back to, but to the latter question, which really embarks upon the long and complex road of local tax structures and their interrelationship to the state tax structure, state general revenue system overall. You know, a real premise of, and I said, I just caution, you know, I think it's very important to understand what language we have before us and where we go from it here. But, you know, part of this is I personally offer to the committee, to the public, you know, there's a real commitment here to follow Representative Weirock's line of questioning to a complete conclusion, and that is whatever we accomplish here must accommodate these local tax structures. We've been referring strictly here to communities with sales taxes. You know, equally relevant are those communities with property taxes. Just as a point of reference, I think it's very important that we look at the aggregate self-assessed self-reliance that communities are taking upon themselves. And I think a fairly fair benchmark of looking at that is the per capita revenue generated from whatever source within communities that has to be considered. And as Representative Weirock pointed out, I think that, and the sales tax project points out, that there is an extreme benefit across this state. If we can find uniformity, we can find consistency, we can make it possible for statewide businesses to work amongst jurisdictions with making that statewide business relatively transparent. To that end, you know, I'm, you know, certainly working with the representatives of the communities. I see the Alaska Municipal League hiding in the back corner here of this conference room, and I would like to meet with you when this is over, please. The point is that, you know, an indigenous is an absolutely vital dialogue that we pursue here, and something that you and I were noticing this morning, or I was pointing out, that as divergent as interests are in these in our communities, the per capita burden on Fairbanks, aggregate, combined borough and city and municipality of Anchorage is less than $2 per capita difference on our, we've got consistent local burdens. The local tax burden in the city of Wrangell, which is off-sited as a, you know, a community that has a very, you know, high tax burden, is less than $60 per capita over that of Anchorage and Fairbanks. So again, I think if we can, again, I want to put this is a vital conversation, but I'd like to be sure we've got a box around it and know that we're looking to the streamlined sales tax system offers efficiency, consistency, facilitates business in the state, but that we as policymakers are, and I concur completely with Representative Wyrock's question, that the great fear is that this bill and this process does not become pandering to special interests. I think it's a critical element here. So I just, I'd like to frame that as a dialogue to continue with. And thank you for the indulgence, Mr. Chairman.
Not a problem. Indulge at any opportunity that we are given. If I might, for the record, this record housekeeping is becoming cumbersome, and I wish someone else would indulge in it. But nonetheless, for the record, Mr. Representative Gruenberg has joined us, as have Representatives Wolf and Crawford. We will move forward then, Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You were talking about the exemptions for a local community, Community A. Do they have to, would all the exemptions have to be the same statewide, or would all the definitions for an individual community have to just fall under the definitional?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, state statute would set the exemptions.
Thank you.
The municipal exemptions would go away. They would lose that authority.
Thank you.
Representative, on that point.
Megan, excuse me for jumping in here, but perhaps to help folks frame this, the answers, preempting some of your answers and providing a very detailed response. The way the Streamlined Sales Tax Project is structured is that they have at the moment, over their years of existence, developed a series of position papers on just those subjects, and such as the subject I believe that Representative Samuels just raised was really the issue of multiple rates, multiple tax bases. But, I get through the information readily, and we'll get copies distributed and available as we get more information, but there's detailed papers on those subjects that kind of fills out the sales taxes, and again, position concept that they would guide us towards.
Okay. For the record, that was Representative Hawker. Representative Ogg.
Yes, there are a couple questions, but first one would be on administration, cost of administration. How would that differ? A municipality like Kodiak has a 6% they've been collecting for quite a while, probably not different than other municipalities, and they have their own administrative structure to collect that. It's a cost. How would the state's cost differ from that?
Through the chair, Representative, the bill and the fiscal note before you assumes that the state would assume the total cost of enforcing, administering, and collecting the sales tax. Municipalities, cities, boroughs could shut down their sales tax collection efforts, so they would have a savings. Then I suppose to the committee it becomes a policy call. Does the state want to pay the total cost of administering, enforcing, collecting, auditing sales tax and just send the check to Kodiak or to Petersburg or to Anchorage if they were to adopt a sales tax? Or would the state want to charge the municipalities for the services they're providing? Currently, in the bill before you in the fiscal note, the assumption is the state pays the total cost of administering sales tax in Alaska and just sends the check to the cities.
So the result would be there would be no administrative costs. Say if a city municipality like Kodiak had 6%, they would just receive their 6% sales tax, no administrative cost.
Through the chair, as written now, that is correct. The communities would see the revenue. And I guess you could make the argument they would save the administrative costs as it's prepared now.
Representative Ogg, through the chair, if I could make one observation.
Dan, please identify yourself.
Yes, this is Dan Dickinson from the Department of Revenue. I have been to a streamlined sales tax meeting, and this issue was hotly debated there. What you might find is that Kodiak wishes to have someone whose job it is or whose part-time job is to come and look over the state's records and look at what's going on and look at the distribution. In other words, Kodiak may just not want to take the check and say, looks about right. Again, it would be a policy question. The legislature may say the state will do everything necessary, and then the municipality may or may not choose to have some degree of interaction with that to convince themselves and be comfortable that what they're doing makes sense. And I would, again, as an analogy, do the model of what happens with the statewide property taxes that we assess, but the localities are very interested in that process and what happens.
Representative Ogg, please continue.
And then the second area, the devil's always in the details, and I'll try to stay out of that because I think that that'll be a very interesting discussion at some point. But it is more on a higher ground. And the question here is, I'm not sure who would actually answer this question. Existing sales tax in some communities are high, 6%, 5%, maybe 7% someplace. And they've really, in essence, taken up the burden. And Representative Hocker has the overall relationship between sales tax and property taxes. Some of the sales taxes have a cap that presently is a fairly low cap, taking into account the community has balanced how certain sales would be encouraged by having that cap. Moving to a statewide sales tax with whatever cap would be put on statewide, and let's say some of these outer communities have relied on sales taxes and they want to continue to rely on the sales tax, not shift it over into property tax. Is there an analysis of what kind of harm would happen to some of these communities where sales would start shifting to larger municipalities like Anchorage, which would not have a sales tax of their own? And so folks may be set with this differential on a new cap on certain items, where in Anchorage they may pay 3%, but in another community pay 8 or 9%. Has there been some analysis of how that kind of impact would take place?
Mr. Persley, please take a stab at it.
Through the chair, Representative, I guess 2 points you raised. Certainly, whether to set a cap, how much to set a cap on, and whether it applies only to certain goods is one of the policy calls that you would have to make in dealing with this legislation. In terms of the analysis, this was discussed at great length during fiscal policy meetings the last couple of years in this building. And the discussion centered on, yes, there's probably somewhere out there a threshold of pain at which point your tax rate is so high that it does begin to affect consumer decisions, purchases. You know, at what point do I say, I'm not going to pay X percent, I'll buy it somewhere else? There's no scientific study that I'm aware of. There's no conclusion reached other than a recognition there probably is a point, but no one knows exactly where it is or what circumstances it would take to get there.
Mr. Chairman, this is Dan Dickinson. If I may add a point on tax caps and thresholds.
Please do.
Streamlined Sales Tax Act, there would be a phase out of caps and thresholds, and they would be gone for any participating state by December 31st, 2005. However, recognizing the importance of them, their following classes of property, of sales of property, would be exempted, and those are motor vehicles, aircraft, modular homes, manufactured homes, mobile homes. In other words, I think if you think about the major purchases that Alaskans and Americans have, their homes aren't covered because that's real property, and their motor vehicles aren't covered because they have a specific exemption under the under the uniform sales tax. We could have separate caps on those. But as I think about caps, at least, and the tourist comes up here and buys a fur coat, I don't see why they shouldn't be carrying full tax on it. But those, the motor vehicles, aircraft, watercraft, and kinds of homes are exempted.
Representative Ogg, are you satisfied?
So you're saying under this particular act that those items, motor vehicles, motor homes, motor boats, aircraft, they're exempt under this 293? Is that?
Mr. Dickinson, that question is to you, please.
Dan Dickinson again. Under the Streamlined Sales Tax Act, if we were to hook up with that act and become a participating member, we could no longer have caps. However, we could continue to have caps on the sale of those items, of motor vehicles, aircraft, watercraft, and modular homes. For example, you know, Tennessee, for example, has a limit on an airplane over $100,000. I'm guessing that has something to do with a large business that's headquartered there. So we could continue to make exceptions and place caps on how much an Alaskan would have to pay when they purchased a car or a boat. That's the exemption I'm talking about. We would not be exempting it from the sales tax.
Okay. Yes, so my understanding is that's the devil in the details.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair summation at this point. Representative Wilson has been very patient. We're going to go to her and then back to Representative Hocker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess one of the questions I have is, right now the municipalities do the collecting themselves, and if the state takes over, how is the state going to do that? Are they going to contract out to the local person, or the local community, to collect the taxes? Or are they going to send somebody from the State Department to each town? Or is it going to be local hire? How does that work?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the state would set up a sales tax office. We would not contract it out to communities. The whole point of a streamlined sales tax of a central administration is one place for business to send their checks, one agency that is going to do audits and enforcement work. So, no, it would be a central state sales tax office and then satellite offices, perhaps in larger cities. And as Mr. Dickinson pointed out, communities may want to keep someone on their staff to monitor state collections and state enforcement. But it'd be like motor fuel or fishery taxes. It would be collected, administered by the state. In the case of fishery business tax, fishery resource landing tax, the state collects it, enforces it, and sends the money back to municipalities.
Just one follow-up. So, kind of in other words, what will happen in some communities that the person that is doing the majority of that work in that community would just lose their job, probably.
Through the chair, I guess, or as Mr. Dickinson pointed out, the community may want to keep that position to monitor sales tax collections, to make sure that the state is collecting everything for their community. Or, you know, not speaking for the city, certainly perhaps by attrition, the person would just take another job, but the cities would have the option of eliminating that position or assigning it to other duties.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
You may.
Representative Wilson, this is Dan Dickinson, you know, the tax division again. One observation I would make is this does not affect the special excise taxes. And as I look through the various things, the raw fish taxes, the bed taxes, those are still going to be a local option, and those may, in fact, still need administrators. This only refers to the broad-based sales tax.
Thank you.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How about internet sales?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair. That, in fact, I think is a lot of the focus of the Streamlined Sales Tax Act. The same rules apply. If Amazon.com doesn't have a substantial presence here in the state, and it sends books, records, whatever the things you can buy from Amazon.com these days in, they have no obligation to collect a sales tax, either for the localities or if the state had a statewide sales tax, they would have no obligation to do that. Once this streamlined sales tax project were in place, the notion is then we could, there still would not be an obligation under the current Supreme Court rules, but the notion is either through a court decision or through federal legislation, they would then be required to. I think another point to make is Amazon.com is fine with collecting taxes as long as it's fairly simple. They just don't want to get caught in the crunch of not knowing what they have to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Dickinson. Looping back to the first question, the line of question that was raised by Representative Wyrock, do you by chance have a copy of the Uniform Sales and Use Tax Administration Act at your fingertips?
Yes, sir, I do.
Could you explain and address Section 5 in that act, and that this would be the act that authorizes the state to enter into a streamlined sales and use tax agreement with other states, but the relationship of that of this act, those agreements, to state law?
Thank you. Yes, sir. And a partner to the chair. In fact, I had this originally in my testimony and cut it out when I tried to get down to the several minutes that I know you wanted to hear. But what Section 5 does, and it may be the easiest if I read it, it's just three sentences, and it just says, no provision of the agreement authorized by this act in whole or in part invalidates or amends any provision of the law of this state. Adoption of the agreement by this state does not amend or modify any law of this state. Implementation of any condition of the agreement in this state, whether adopted before, at, or after membership of the state in this agreement, must be an action of this state. In other words, I think to get back to what I tried to express at the beginning, all this act does is set out the broad framework and say, we're going to enter into an agreement with one or any number of other states, and the notion is right now that it'd be with 38 other states, and the agreement is set out, so we now have the goal of trying to bring our sales tax administration in line with the principles that we're enunciating here. What, of course, gives us the head start here is, while we certainly have to deal with municipalities and their histories, and I'm not trying to short that will be a very important task, we don't have any state process or state procedures or state laws to dismantle and then remantle. So I think what you've identified there is critical, that all the Uniform Act does is set the goals. And there's one other sentence that I think is important in that Section 7 that says, this agreement authorized by this Act is an accord among individual cooperating sovereigns in furtherance of their governmental functions. So this does not create some agency that's going to come in and tell us what to do. It's basically going to say, gee, if you do this the same way the other states are doing, we all get a mutual benefit.
Thank you very much.
Representative Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little confused on what items are taxable. For example, say a module built in the Kenai and bought by the flying service that buys an airplane. Are those things, are we only talking personal property? Are we talking, would those things also be taxable?
Mr. Persley.
Mr. Chair, real property would not be taxable under this, and perhaps Mr. Dickinson would want to address the question, because if it's bought by industry for another use, Dan, would you want to address that?
Certainly. Representative Hines, through the chair, Dan Dickinson with the Tax Division. Again, let's go to that legal. Sometimes we all get confused by the notion of personal property. Property is either real or personal. So, for example, I'm always shocked when we do our annual valuation of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. That's considered personal property. So, to give the two examples, to look at the two examples that you just set forth, yes, those would be subject to a sales and use tax. I think one of the important things to recognize is that it's not just a sales tax, it is a sales and use tax. I think a lot of us who encounter this out of state tend to think of this as something that happens at the cash register. We buy a couple of dollars and then there's a little tax added. But in fact, to make it fair and to make sure that we're simply not swamped by importation from states with a lower sales tax, the use tax portion is very important. Now, as a matter of fact, if I go out of state and buy a fancy sofa in Seattle and ship it up here, I'm probably not going to fill out the paperwork. And in fact, if I could show that that I'd already paid sales tax in Washington State, I could take that a credit against the Alaska sales tax and I wouldn't have to pay anything. But an important part is how, again, it's going to be entirely up to the legislature, how you deal with industrial purchases. So in some states, any business input, anything purchased to create wealth to use in a business is exempt. At the other extreme, you have states that say only if the things you buy that you're actually going to end up reselling are exempt. So, for example, if I have a business, building chairs, let's say, at the one extreme, we'd say, okay, the wood and the varnish are tax exempt, but the tools that I use, the hammers, the saws, the planers, the finishers, are not. At the other extreme, if you had a blanket exemption for business, you would say, yes, those tools are. That's one of the decisions that you're going to have to make. In this bill, we have a fairly, this puts forward a, I'll say a fairly narrow restriction about on exemptions in terms of business inputs. But that's something that varies greatly between states, and as you can imagine, some states any agricultural input is exempt, in other states any manufacturing input is exempt, and that's among the policies that you will have to make.
Representative Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dickinson, I've noticed in the bill analysis it says certain exemptions, ingredients or components used in manufacturing. So saying the module that's built in the Kenai on its way to Prudhoe Bay, are you saying then that those components would not be taxed, but the completed module would?
Representative Hines, again, we as I think one of your colleagues observed, the devil is in the details. If they were being purchased buy, let's say a firm in Kenai were to purchase all the inputs, create them into a module, and then sell that to a producer on the North Slope. When they purchased the inputs, they would not be taxed. When they sold that module, it would be taxed. If the entire process were owned by the producer, in other words, they just had a Kenai firm fabricating it, then as those inputs were brought in, they would be taxed. If those inputs were purchased in the lower 48 and brought up here, then they would be taxed under the use tax portion of the act.
If I might give some input, the notion is that an item is taxed once. That's the end that is trying to be achieved.
So
please continue.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So then you couldn't tax the components, then tax it again once it's built.
I suppose if we wanted that policy, we could make that happen, but we're trying to not let that happen.
Okay.
And Representative Hines, through the chair, and I think that observation is precisely right, and that's why if you go to Section 250 of the bill in front of you, it allows a credit against a use tax or a sales tax paid in another state. So anything that you bring in here, if you can show that you paid tax on it, if it was a lower rate, you'd have to make up the difference. But if you've already paid tax on it, then we're not going to dun you again.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
I know this is going to sound crazy, but thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, well, I mean, what about a restaurant person that's running a restaurant? I mean, I know this sounds, when he buys the ingredients for the salad, he doesn't pay a tax for it, but then when he sells the salad to the customer, he pays a tax? Is that what it is?
Mr. Dickinson.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, let me just tell you, yesterday I was we have a monthly, they're called brown bag lunch, tax roundtables where a bunch of other CPAs sit down and talk about things. It may not be the most high-octane of meetings, but they were asking a bunch of questions, too, none of these questions are out of line. People who haven't dealt with this, you just start asking questions. I think your question is a very good one. The notion is, and there's a lot of space spent on this bill on how you create certificates and exemptions, and it would be precisely for that kind of a business. If you choose to exempt all business inputs, then the restaurateur is going to have, when they go out and they buy lettuce and all those kinds of things, they would not pay tax. There would be a tax on the meal. What you try to do is you try to set up a system so that when they go to the store, they simply present their certificate, which says, you know, if, for example, let's say we built in the broad exemption that any purchase for resale was exempt. So they would say, okay, I'm going to be a reseller. When I purchase this, I'm exempt. The problem is, in a recent court case, for example, a funeral parlor had bought 50-gallon tanks of weed killer, and the court ruled that that was not a reasonable use and that the business honoring their exemption certificate should have asked more questions. So this gets into, again, one of the reasons why this bill is so long is it deals with the obligations that businesses have to each other when resale certificates are presented or exemption certificates are presented. Maybe I've gone a lot further than you wanted to, but I think you identified the principle correctly, one of your colleagues did, that we only tax it once, and if the notion is it's a business input, all business inputs would be not taxed.
Okay.
If I may add, we also have a concept called a direct pay certificate. If, for example, and a restaurant might be a good business, if we exempted only the things that were resold but not the things that contributed to that resale. So, for example, one of the big fights is about things like napkins and silverware. If napkins and silverware aren't used up by the restaurant but they're continually buying them and they have to pay sales tax on them, but they don't have to pay sales tax on, as you said, the bread and the lettuce, what you might have is a direct pay certificate. And what that means is the restaurant simply waives its exemption to anybody that it purchases from and never pays tax, and then it has to sit down on a monthly basis, figure out how many of its purchases were taxable and how many were not, and then pay us for those that were taxable. And it may be easier for the accountants that work for the business to sit down and figure that out than try to do it at the time of each purchase. And that's what the direct pay certificate portions of legislation would be.
Easy enough to understand.
Be succinct and broad, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right, I think we've reached the point that we can move back to the fiscal note and the attachments with it. Mr. Pursley, the second page, the fourth page, 4 of 5, the department recommends adding the following provisions to the legislation. Now we begin to get into some of the details. If you could work us through that, there are 25 of them. I will leave it up to you as to what detail you go into each of them. I would suggest that if the committee has questions on any of these items, that we stop Mr. Pursley at the point that you have the question, and we let the discussion proceed appropriately. Mr. Pursley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we'll rely on Mr. Dickinson as appropriate, but the first two simply deal with the streamlined sales tax. We believe there should be something in the legislation that directs us to write regulations that are consistent with streamlined sales tax, particularly a section detailing sourcing of services. Where did the taxable transaction occur? What's the source? The third one deals with bartering. I'm not proposing one or the other, but the legislation really should deal with whether we exempt or tax bartering. Certainly, let's face it, taxing bartering is going to be very difficult to enforce. So you could have it in the code and not enforce it, or you could exempt it. But no doubt there is a fair amount of bartering in Alaska. It's something that should be addressed. Number four, as Mr. Dickinson just discussed, was the direct pay permits, allowing us to issue them. I would describe several of the others as technical, consolidating the different sections, addressing liability. Just so people know the history of this bill that you have before you, a few years ago, the Department of Revenue hired someone on a short-term contract to help us put together research and I don't want to say a model sales tax bill, but a draft sales tax bill. We had not been asked to do it. It wasn't before the legislature. It wasn't tasked to us by the administration, but we felt someday it might happen. We wanted to have some research to start with. So what you see here today comes from that project a few years ago. We've pulled it out a couple times since, done some work to it, but as you can see from our 25 suggestions, some are significant, some are housekeeping, technical, typographical. The bill, or the draft sales tax bill that we provided to the House Ways and Means Committee upon request just several days ago was a work in progress and still needs some technical changes to it, such as item 6, where we're suggesting to delete the first sentence and add a however. We want to make it clear as in item 7 that it's a sales and use tax so that each reference refers to both. 9 deals with nexus, which is, as Mr. Dickinson discussed, that connection that you need to have taxing jurisdiction over an entity. And currently, under existing law, existing court case, you're talking about a physical presence of some kind in your state. That's why Amazon.com that sells into Alaska, we currently, if we had a state sales tax, or those municipalities with a sales tax, cannot require Amazon.com to collect sales tax for the community. It doesn't have a nexus. We want this legislation to say that to the full extent is allowed by the U.S. Constitution that we could collect sales tax. And Mr. Dickinson, perhaps you'd have something to add on that issue.
Dan, if you'd like, go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, no, I mean, I think Larry has summed it up very aptly, and the notion is this is something that is hopefully will be changing in the near term. So the notion would be to make it just a very broad that we, you know, whatever the rules are out there, we follow them and not try to create our own set of rules.
Okay. Mr. Pursley?
Yeah. Number 11 gets down to certificates, and I guess from personal experience, I'll give an example in Juneau. In Juneau, if you get a building permit, all purchases under that permit are exempt from sales tax. It's an incentive to get a building permit, which has its own value to the owner of the structure and to the next owner of the structure. So you get a certificate, a card, that if you go to a lumber store, go to a hardware store, to a supplier and buy items for that project under that building permit number, they log it in, those items are tax exempt. But they have to be related to the project. And example is, I was doing a remodel project, went out to a hardware store in town, bought items for it, without thinking, also bought a bag of de-icer for the sidewalk. And the sales clerk was very good and said, sir, I can't sell you that de-icer bag on that tax-exempt certificate purchase. It doesn't qualify. But that certificate was not for that transaction, but any transactions related to that project. That would be more of a blanket certificate as opposed to a transaction certificate. This section allows two kinds, whether it's blanket or for a specific transaction. You need to provide something to the business so they know how to treat that sale so that they're protected. Item 13 deals with section 4340.090 on page 4, which exempts government purchases from sales tax, state, federal, city, municipal, school district. It also lists Indian tribe. This would amend it to federally recognized Indian tribe. I'm looking for those that are not just technical. And other than a few more that deal with adopting the streamlined sales tax definitions, I'm not aware of any here that are significant. Dan, do you know anything about any of the others that would lead you to believe they are significant changes?
Dan Dickinson, Tax Division. Noller, I think you're right, although I'll make not totally facetious, they will be very important to some people.
Right, and not to minimize them, Mr. Chair, but just that a lot of the others are not significant policy calls, but items as we're trying to clean this bill up for the committee.
Very good. Thank you, gentlemen. Representative Hawker.
Thank you. Well, we're looking at some of these directions to take as we start working on revisions to this bill. Question for the department. Do you think we should consider incorporating a separate rate structure, and that would be, in my opinion, a substantially higher rate structure on sales of contraband and the performance of illegal services?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I'm not really sure if there's a good way to answer that question.
it's posed in all seriousness.
I'm sure it is. Hadn't thought about that until right now.
Representative, through the chair, Dan Dickinson, let me make the observation that if we are going to hook up with a streamlined sales tax, we are allowed one general rate, although we are allowed a different rate for drugs, and I suppose there may be an interesting intersection there, but I don't know if that's what they had in mind.
Okay, we might have to get to that through a separate excise tax.
Representative Hawker, that's clear. And one thing I do want to emphasize, if we wanted to put a separate excise tax on marijuana or something of that nature, that is permissible.
Thank you.
That's thought-provoking, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for Dan. Dan, in the process of us working out the details of this, one of the important points of a good sales and use tax is fairness. Now, in Alaska, because of the vast distances that products travel to get to here and there, I'm looking at the cost of a gallon of milk. And in Wrangell, a gallon of milk is like $3.99. And so if there was a 3% sales tax, we'd be only paying 12 cents. However, in Nome, a gallon of milk is $5.69. So that means the people in Nome would be paying 17 cents. In Kotzebue, a gallon of milk is $8, and so they would be paying 24 cents for that same gallon of milk. In Anchorage, that gallon of milk is only $3.49, and so they'd only be paying 10 cents on that gallon of milk. How do we work out fairness in this with Alaska? Because a citizen in Kotzebue will be paying twice as much sales tax for an item as somebody in Wrangell would. And so when we're looking at that, how do we deal with these the unfairness of it?
Representative Hines, through the chair, I think you've made a very good observation.
Excuse me, Dan.
I would compare this with something like the cigarette tax or the motor fuel tax, which is based on a unit, not on the price. And so everybody pays the same tax per unit purchase, not on the same price. And that may be a fairer way of doing it. However, when you get to a sales tax, I guess there are two ways of looking at fairness. One is you treat everybody the same based on how much they spend, and the other one is you go to that per unit basis. And if you have a broad tax, it really is very hard to go to a per unit basis. Now, one of the things that you can do is, for example, some states that tax food allow a credit, essentially like the earned income credit, if you will, but allow a remission or a payment back to low-income families who are paying a disproportionately large portion of their income on taxes because they spend a disproportionately large portion on food. For the example you gave, maybe you'd say, gee, if you have transportation that's off-road, we would remit something extra to citizens paying that tax. There are a number of ways of dealing with this, Representative Hines, and I think the most common one would be to keep it outside the sales tax system but make it a remission to the targeted group, a remit back to the targeted group so that they essentially receive back some of what they've paid in if you feel they've paid disproportionately.
Just to make sure that the record is clear, that was Representative Wilson asking the question. Do you have a follow-up, Representative Wilson? Was your question answered?
Well, it's partially. And I understand what he said, but I think it's going to be very difficult because the distances involved, the transportation costs add up, and so that happens in every area, not just food, but in everything else, too.
Mr. Persley.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. I guess, realistically, if the legislature wants a sales and use tax as part of a fiscal plan, I think one of the hurdles to overcome is the acceptance that there is, depending on the eye of the beholder, a certain unfairness that if I pay more for the same product as someone else, I'm going to have to pay more tax. And that is not easy to get around. I think you're right. There's already those items cost more in Nome than they do in Anchorage, whether it's milk, whether it's getting a car into town, whether it's buying clothes. A sales tax is going to add a few pennies more to the unfairness, if that's what you want to call it, of where you live. But there's really no easy way out of that.
One follow-up. I think paying back so much to those areas is a really good idea. We'll have to think about that.
I think Representative Hines and then Representative Hawker.
Mr. Persley, I've noticed on in the bill it's the sale of natural gas is not exempt. So I'm thinking of Agrium buying natural gas, the power in rural Alaska. It's going to have a really large impact, isn't it?
Through the chair, the section that you refer to deals with the final sale at retail level. Utilities are not tax exempt. I believe, and Mr. Dickinson can correct me if I'm wrong, but that component in a manufacturing process would be tax exempt. Is that correct, Dan?
Yes, if you didn't. Yes.
Okay.
Short answer.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, with Representative Wilson's line of questioning, we've drifted back into the issue of fairness and equalization across the state. I certainly concur with Mr. Dickinson's response that if the measure is truly to be, the same dollar to be essentially collected across the state for each citizen, no matter where one resides, you do have to look at a unitized assessment structure. Gasoline being a very good example. No matter where you're at, it's 8 cents. Where it's difficult to say, unless Mr. Dickinson would like to set up a system that we unitize every commodity sold in the state of Alaska, which probably is somewhat unworkable, but getting back, recognizing that dilemma exists here, that problem exists, that is part of accommodating local revenue structures in the concept of a structuring here. And I think you very much concur with Representative Wilson that some structure that does have an equalizing effect. But when we start looking at the basic unit in Alaska, the basic unit is a human being. And the basic, and again, we start looking at per capita structures and a mechanism to level, equalize in some manner the per capita, revenue structure and anticipating and equalizing the desired is a local contribution, local self-reliance on a per capita structure. And we've got a lot of room here to work towards a solution that does balance, balance and address the problems raised by Representative Wilson, which are probably the most daunting challenges in this entire process.
Representative Holmes.
Oh, I think my question was answered, and you're saying that I don't understand.
Okay. Through the chair, to answer Representative Hines' question again, my understanding is that the gas bought by Agrium to turn into fertilizer, they would not pay sales tax on that gas.
And the natural gas for, say, Chugach Electric over in Beluga Point, that is not taxable?
My understanding is the gas they purchase would not, but then when they sell that electricity to a customer, they would pay sales tax on the electricity generated from that gas.
Okay.
All right. Representative Ogg.
Yeah, just to follow up on what Representative Wilson was talking about, and I was just thinking that some kind of credit, it would seem like impossible to credit individuals, but you may do it on a community basis based on a CPI, something like that, where you're something similar to the student formula where you pick some place that's a one. And if then a community would get that credit back, not the individuals, and at least that way you're balancing out something that would allow those communities to lower what Representative Hawker is talking about here, the differentials. So just an idea.
Sure. And it's an idea that we are working on, something simple like the student formula. And therein lies the problem.
Absolutely.
But we are addressing that, and we understand that it is necessary to do so. Mr. Pursley, did you have further comments on the analysis by the Revenue Department?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have further comments. In addition, just to identify for members what we presented to you besides for the fiscal note and that summary of the streamlined sales tax, there were a couple other handouts. One is a summary of a statewide sales tax just to give you some information on what other states charge, what other cities and boroughs do, what cities and boroughs do in Alaska, how much we think we would raise. Who would pay a tax, and roughly we estimate that about 10% of the year-round sales tax would be paid by out-of-state residents, visitors, people who come here and work temporarily. The other item, which is titled Building Blocks, just raises some of the policy issues and technical issues that you would need to consider as you craft a sales tax bill in the days ahead. How you deal with leases. Manufacturing, food that we've discussed here, and how do you define manufacturing? So we wanted to try to present as much information so members could familiarize themselves with the decisions that need to be made and some of the issues that you're facing.
Thank you. Lots of information, a huge issue, driven by thank you. Housekeeping continues. So we have we were not going to take public testimony today. However, there is a person who cannot testify tomorrow when we may take public testimony. I therefore want to give this person an opportunity to give her testimony. If the committee will please indulge me then. Thank you. She is no longer with us.
That sounds fatal.
I hope not. All right. Big issue. Lots to think about. Lots of information. It's not a new issue to those of us who have been here. Put it in context, this is a component to a larger fiscal plan. It's a necessary component. I suggest that the committee members give it a great deal of thought. Come back with your ideas. Feel free to have access to Representative Hawker and myself and our staff. We're here to help. We want to find a solution. We will do all that we can to help committee members. Thank you.
Representative Coring.
Representative Coring, and then Wilson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair. I just have a concern in regard to the sponsor statement, and I don't think that you necessarily meant the statement to reflect the will of the entire committee, but that does strongly suggest that it's the whole committee that is behind sales tax here. So I just wanted to make a respectful recommendation that that this be rewritten, but just tweaked a bit to say perhaps it's at the suggestion of the co-chairs or word it in some generic way so it doesn't apply that all committee members do support this sales tax, and I'm sure you have come to the conclusion that I don't. So I just wanted to make that recommendation here because it does, in the first paragraph, say the committee proposes a state sales use tax, and then it goes on to talk about the committee's belief that we should use this as a necessary component for our spending concerns, just kind of a paraphrasing. And make reference that we should also add to that the permanent fund legislation that we have before us, too, on the percent of market value methodology. So I would just ask that we tweak this a little bit for future use, if you would, please.
Sure. We're happy to do that, Representative Coring. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make the comment. I agree with the past speaker, but even if we're looking at a sales tax and looking at some mechanism to pay back the municipality, that still does not take care of the fact that the individual citizens in that community have already paid, of course I'll use Wrangell because it would be the one with the highest sales tax in the state. It will not pay back those individual citizens for the extra that they had to pay, which in Wrangell, if it was a 3%, would be 10%. And so I think we really have our work cut out for us. I look forward to working with you to see if we can make this work so that it's fair, I'm for it. But if we cannot work it out so that it's fair, then I definitely would be opposed to it.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. We'll all have an opportunity to speak our minds. The process will continue. Tomorrow we'll be discussing HJR 9 and HJR 26. It is my hope that we have the wherewithal as a committee to move those bills to committee after significant discussion and analysis tomorrow, recognizing that we are the initial committee of referral, both of those significant components to a fiscal plan. Thank you all, and we are adjourned.